This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds and academia. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It is episode 225 with Marcus Sivin. He is an art critic, a performance artist, and now the chairman of the art department at UNLV, that is the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And what a great guy. We talk all about how he's risen up the ladder of academia, his performance art in general. I challenge him quite a bit there, and he parries back quite nicely. We talk also about the culture of academia and UNLV students in particular at this moment in 2018, this hot moment. So a lot to look forward to. Great guy to talk to, great guy in general. I think you will enjoy it. Before we get there, I want to let you know that this episode is brought to you by the Lonely Palette podcast. I bet you're the kind of person who skips the audio tour at museum shows. Well, Tamara Avishai of the Lonely Palette skips them too. She knows they're just the beginning of the story. In each episode of The Lonely Palette, host Tamara Avishai interviews unsuspecting passersby in front of one artwork and captures their descriptions. From there, she crafts a 20-minute audio essay about why it matters, its movement, its social context, and anything and everything else that will make it as accessible to you as it is interesting to her. Check out all the episodes at thelonelypalette.com or follow The Lonely Palette on social media at Lonely Palette on Twitter and at The Lonely Palette on Instagram. All right, so before we jump in on the back end, we've got several Weiss links, including an update on art and controversy in Boyle Heights and the ingeniously self-crafted legacy of artist Dale Henry, whom I had not heard of either. But it's an interesting story, so stay tuned for that on the back end. Just a few things to know before we jump in. One is that Marcus's end of the call has a staticky quality to it. I apologize for that. Mainly, it's just the first 10 minutes, so please stick with it. The quality does improve at that point. Another is that towards the end of the call, Marcus talks about the Chris Burden piece called Shoot. If you're not familiar with it by any chance, please look it up. I'm not going to do it justice with just a cursory description. And lastly, before we jump into the conversation, Marcus is talking about why he decided to apply for and then accept his position at UNLV Art Department Chair, moving out west from MICA in Baltimore. So here we go. Talk to you more on the back end. Stay tuned.
I was looking for a change. I think, like a lot of people, when Donald Trump was elected president, they started asking themselves a lot of hard questions about their own lives. I thought I was doing more as an administrator in an arts context with the choices I was making than I really was. And I don't know if I'm doing more now, but when I got the call from Las Vegas to apply for this position, being at a public university with a student population that's 70% students of color, and a state university that really sees itself in its ideal as serving the community and serving the state, felt like something, you know, a good way to apply my talent.
Got it. So you actually got a call from them. So it was an invitation that made it easier than you just sort of waking up, you know, in November of 2016 and going, where can I go or what can I do to maybe create more change?
Yeah, and I never would have located Las Vegas as a possibility. I'm not somebody who, you know, Las Vegas wasn't really part of my imagination or my imagined career path.
Yeah.
But when I arrived here and I got onto campus and I saw the community and the context, I got excited.
Right. That's pretty thoughtful to me that you, many people woke up in back in November of 2016 and either sooner or later said, you know, I got to get involved. I got to help change things. It sounds like, I guess I should go back to the fact that you got this call. I mean, what were you thinking before you got that call in terms of what kind of change you might make?
Well, like you said, I really love being at MICA and I love the work. It was a lot of procedural work and a lot of behind the scenes work. And I wasn't, although I felt like I was having a big impact on the students and their lives, I was working, you know, mostly with the faculty. I wasn't in the classroom much any longer. And my performance work was, you know, didn't come into play as much on the job.
Right.
You know, it was something I was doing and everyone was supportive of, but it, you know, I wasn't teaching a performance class or anything like that.
Right.
And so to be in a situation where I had, you know, daily contact with students who were working their way through school and many of whom are the first in their families to go to college. And I could engage with them, as an administrator. The chair has a lot of administrative responsibilities, but also I could engage with them in the classroom. This really felt quite special.
Are you going to be teaching a class this semester?
Yeah, Wednesday nights. I wish you could take it.
Oh, well, thank you for the invitation. Next time I'm in Vegas, I'll make sure to stop by. Is it a performance class?
Yep.
Okay.
Performance and media art, and the subtitle is Performance Lab.
Got it. Okay. So the thing that stuck out to me of what you were just saying is that, especially in terms of your ambition to have an impact on our culture and our, you know, and particularly our crumbling American culture, is that it sounds like you are going to have more of an hands-on approach and interaction to molding young students in who they become. And that really probably, especially in comparison to what you were describing at MICA, makes it feel more vital. Is that fair?
Yeah, and MICA is a small school. The tuition is higher. The students are often coming, you know, with different motivations in terms of the, you know, they've selected MICA and the great experience at MICA. Whereas at UNLV, I'm brand new, so I'm just learning this. But it seems like for a lot of students in Nevada and in parts of surrounding states, you know, they grow up thinking if they were to go to school, this is where they would go to school. And then they, you know, choose their major second. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah.
There's a little bit, it's just a wider swath of people.
If I'm a first generation college student, you know, the first individual in my family to go to university, and I'm thinking, what am I going to take? What do I want to be? You would think just on a practical level that studying art, fine art, would not be among the top choices.
Yeah. You would think it's a, we're turning them away. All our classes, at UNLV are full.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of goes against conventional logic. And this is both in, you know, what's traditionally thought of as the fine arts or the visual arts, and also graphic design and art history. There's an email or two in my inbox every day saying, how do I get into this class? I want to take this class so bad.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we have some of that, you know, those ideas wrong about what people want from the arts and who wants the arts.
Yeah, right. Huh.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't studied it comprehensively, but at least what I'm seeing on the ground here in Las Vegas seems to suggest that this generation of students, and this population in Nevada, that people love art.
Okay, that's interesting. One of the things I was thinking was that, well, there are just so many students now because of the population spurt that we're having generally, that at accredited and even, you know, affordable, accredited and well-respected universities, that they're just going to be, the enrollment's just going to be huge across the board. And so therefore, because of that formula, you're going to have filled up art classes. That was my thought as you were saying that. But then as you finish your comment, you know, you sort of clarified, well, in fact, a lot of these students just want to take art classes. Have you, I guess maybe the best way to sort of ask it, and I know it's probably too early, but I'm going to try anyway, is that have you had a conversation yet with a first generation college student who's in the art department and why they chose that?
I mean, yes. There are some who, you know, they already had selected as artists, right? Like they went to an arts magnet high school in the area. And there are some who took a class for, you know, there is an arts requirement on campus, right? And so they take an arts requirement class and then they just really like it. They find out they're good, they're encouraged.
Yeah.
I was just talking to a student today who's actually ambidextrous and she can draw from observation the same quality with both hands.
Mm.
We were talking about other things, but when she brought this up, I was like, that's special. You know, we should talk more, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I have a lot to learn. I think I'm going a lot on just sort of hunches and instincts now. I think as well, what I've observed just anecdotally, both at MICA and here, is that there's just a lot of work to do in education in general, you know, starting in K-12, that if you walk into some schools, everybody who works there, like in Baltimore, there's a school called the Baltimore Design School. And from the first time you sign in at the front door, everyone's talking about college. Everybody.
Yeah.
You know, all the students, all the faculty, all the staff, people working in the cafeteria, everybody, right?
Mm.
And I think that's the kind of culture that we want. That's the kind of culture I was fortunate to grow up in. With the way I grew up, it was a little too much sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, we want all students to know that, you know, college is an option, that it's there. And, you know, at least some of the meetings, the strategy meetings that I've been in with other colleagues who I'm learning from, you know, we have recruitment and retention specialists on staff at UNLV, for example. You know, they're talking about that somebody whose family isn't as familiar with college, the sort of the rituals of college life and the expectations of a college professor might be, you know, really unfamiliar and might, you know, the students might need some discussion around that or some training around that, those kind of some mentoring.
Have you had a follow-up conversation with the ambidextrous student yet?
Oh, well, I mean, that was just today.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, great. So I'm getting in on the ground floor. So here's my thought on her, and you can let her know this and report back to me, okay? I'm thinking court reporter, sketch artist, because no matter where she has to sit in the courtroom, she can take it. She's got elbow room on either side.
I love it, and I will take that back to her.
Awesome. I don't think I could ask for more. I'm curious to know how you rose, ascended, and have moved through the academic world so rather swiftly. To what extent was it you were sort of almost supernaturally guided into it and through it, you know, with your being the third generation, you know, in administration that we talked about a minute ago, versus just, you know, that you really had to be intentional about it, that there was a lot you had to learn on your own that you were not born with, and figure out the politics, the application procedures, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, I like the supernatural line of thinking.
Uh-huh.
It almost, you know, I've always wanted academia to be a TV show, you know, like somehow like the arts department to be a TV show.
Yeah.
But I think it's not interesting enough, but like this podcast might be the closest I get to that dream. So I like the supernatural characterization of anything related to arts administration and art department.
Right. Do you want me to spell that out a little bit more? Here's just to clarify, and then I'll let you go on. Here's how I imagine it. You wake up sometime after you've graduated from your undergraduate art or general liberal arts education, right? And each day you've got a little checklist, either, you know, literally like a type A person, or more sort of intuitively, you know, just in your mind. And you are doing things each day to build the foundation of what one needs to make their way through up the academic ladder.
I love that. And I would, you know, that would be good for like the TV or movie version. I don't want to dissuade anyone from thinking that.
Right.
I think that I've been really lucky and had a lot of great mentors and also what I call tour mentors along the way.
What's a tour mentor?
A tour mentor is a mentor who, you know, is teaching you lessons the hard way.
Interesting. Tough love, in other words?
Tough love, or you learn what not to do by watching what they do.
So in other words, tour mentor is a euphemism for a bad mentor or a don't do it like this mentor.
Yeah, but they might have some qualities that are very endearing, or they might have a certain kind of attentiveness, or you might be in proximity to them and enjoy some things about working to them with
yeah.
them
yeah.
but and engaging with them
right.
but that that they're very tough.
right. Yeah,
for many reasons. And I think I might point to the two things. One is that when I was a college student, I fell in with a group of high school students and college students who, very much we all wanted to learn from our teachers at that time. There were high school teachers and college teachers sort of even involved in this group. This was back in Providence, Rhode Island, when I was a Brown student. But there were public high school students and there were Brown and RISD students. And we started to, really ask some hard questions about, what is art good for, and what does it mean to be an artist, and who gets to be an artist? And we decided that we wanted to learn from each other and from, community members who weren't, high school teachers or professors at a college or a university. And so we started an after-school arts program. And then I that was before I finished college. That was before I finished at Brown. And we incorporated as a nonprofit. We were doing all kinds of things we had no business doing at our age and with how we felt and what we knew. But we did it. And that organization is now almost 22 years old. It's called New Urban Arts in Providence.
Right.
Even a very 90s name that it still has. And so that was, sort of formative for me. And I saw very early on the kind of impact that I could have when working with a group. And I do think, that was the beginning of, I sort of got the bug at that point, And then the other piece is just interdisciplinarity in general, that, the university and most colleges at this point are still structured very much around disciplines. You're studying poetry when you're studying poetry, and poetry doesn't overlap with music, or more to the point, even, you're studying typography, but typography doesn't overlap with drawing, right?
Mm.
My life and my interests have always been strongly interdisciplinary, and I've always, again, almost by luck, met great poets in the elevator, lived next door to amazing performance artists, met sculptors who wanted to collaborate with me on performances. And so in this way, I think I am somewhat of a type within academia, but something of sort of a disruptor within academia, because I'm not particularly tied to any discipline. I love many disciplines, and I feel like I have some grasp of the vocabulary and really like everywhere deep respect for for the traditions. I might, when I have students or faculty in my office or we're planning something, I'm probably the one who is going to be asking questions about, unusual combinations or collaboration in a way that is, very much happening in lots of pockets of the world right now, but it's still, and is happening, at UNLV, but it's still somewhat unfamiliar and somewhat new.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about the New Urban Arts, is that what it was, right? And, and your, the arc of your evolution, in projects and collaborations and academia and so on, that it sounds like, if I'm to read correctly between the lines, that there just has been a tremendous amount of serendipity, that it wasn't like, you know, as an extreme type A person, you said, I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do that. It was more like these kinds of things, all these things from New Urban Arts on sort of organically came together. Is that right?
Yes, I have to confess as well, I am extraordinarily type A, and that's one of the things that I'm working on. I have to work on my patience, and I have to work on understanding that not everyone's interested in the level of detail that I'm interested in.
Right. So there we go. We've got the triumvirate. We've got diplomacy, serendipity, type A, and maybe if we were to add a fourth, genetics.
Yeah, I feel like you're drawing me with both hands here right now.
Ambidextrously drawing you. awesome. So I'm curious, what's an example of when you need to tone down the type A? When do you get impatient with people or situations?
Well, for people who don't know, but I'm guessing a lot of your listeners know, universities and colleges hire a lot of part-time workers, you know, adjuncts, we call them popularly at UNLV. They're called PTIs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is incredibly challenging work to fill a schedule with folks who have other jobs, who are juggling obligations, who very much like teaching, maybe are alumni of the university or a similar university. And so everywhere that I've been, and when I've been a part-timer and a full-timer, this has been sort of some of the everyday logic of the work. It's almost like how to keep the team together.
Yeah.
And how to make sure that you have someone in all the positions on the team.
Right. But your type A would be spot on, would be a huge advantage at sort of figuring out how to fill in all those pieces of the puzzle, right?
Yeah, I love it. And I was on the phone at the end of the day with, you know, I sort of got to the center of a certain kind of vortex, and I was talking to somebody who does, you know, one very detailed aspect of scheduling at the university, and I was so excited. I was like on a high. And mm-hmm. I was like, I can't believe I'm talking to you. You know how to do all these things. and, you know, I want to be your best friend. Like, tell me how to do these things. I want to know how to do them.
Right.
You know, I think like all institutions, but especially a big university or even, sometimes these things happen when places are older, too, that people get in the habit of like just sort of shuffling paper from desk to desk. And, whereas if we all just knew how to do something, we could get it done in 3 minutes, but it takes 3 weeks because it's moving from here to here to here to here to here. You know?
Yeah. It's the inevitable process of bureaucracy. You just, it's unchangeable, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't, yeah, maybe that's what it'll say on my tombstone.
Oh, stop. Okay. Well, you can always earn points with me by self-deprecation. So, But seriously, getting back to you mentioned the adjuncts, you know, who are part of that equation. I wonder how much that phenomena of the particularly the art department adjunct has been on your radar, either prior to MICA, during MICA, and or after MICA, particularly now. But you know, this is a national phenomena in which part-time teachers, aka adjunct, aka in your case PTIs, is that what it was, are, you know, overworked and underpaid and have to do a lot of, and particularly in the Los Angeles area, do a lot of driving, you know, to get to their various adjunct gigs. You know, I think if you can string together enough of them to make a living, you know, that's great. But certainly there's been a conversation where, you know, it seemed to be more prominent in the news or in the cultural conversation around how much they, and presumably that hasn't changed, are being exploited, I guess, in some cases.
Yes, absolutely. Everything that you said sounds true to me in my experience, and I'm complicit in it because I hire part-timers all the time. At MICA, a union formed for the part-timers while I was there. And then as associate dean, I was partly responsible for, you know, following the rules that the union agreement set about. It's a really difficult space. I mean, I think if, God, I wish I knew the solution. I want to approach it first from like a personal point of view, knowing that we have listeners who, you know, probably are in graduate school or considering graduate school or wanting to make a life in part-time or very much on a visceral level experiencing what we're talking about. And I just want to say, like, clearly for those folks, like from the inside, from my heart, I think that you have to know why you're doing it as a part-timer. And I think you have to be really honest with yourself about the money, and you have to come to terms with either what else you're going to do or what kind of sacrifices that you're going to make. And, you know, I do advise graduate students when they're considering teaching as a career, I'll say, look, you can teach almost anywhere at almost any time of day with almost any population of humans, and probably even teach entities that aren't humans, right? And so, you know, think really hard about where you want to teach and what their rewards are gonna be for that teaching, right? And if we have time, I'll go even further with that student, you know, and talk about sort of some of the fringe benefits, right? That sometimes working in a part-time context, you learn a lot, like I did, about the structure of the institution. You learn a lot about a certain population of students, or, you know, I'm someone as well who teaching doesn't take away from my creativity. It actually fuels it. You know, like I've made some of my best drawings and written some of my best scripts right after a class, or, you know, with in mind sort of a response to something that a student created or something we were talking about, you know, but everyone's not like that. You know, there are some folks who it does really pull them away. And so, you know, I guess what I'm saying in a nutshell is it's not for everyone. And B, for some people, it might not. No, I guess that's just, those are both A.
Right.
It's not for everyone.
Right. Well, I think from my perspective, not having been an adjunct, but knowing a little bit about it, the obvious benefit for one is that it's a foot in the door to, you know, an institution, that you are on the radar as being an artist who teaches art, you know, or art history or what have you, or design.
Right.
And yet the question then becomes, in any given situation, what are the chances that you're going to be able to stick around long enough to get hired, you know, as faculty, as staff? I should say faculty
so
in most cases.
A piece that a lot of people don't know, but most, at least that I've come across, maybe all, but I'm going to say most for safety, you know, most full-time positions, there has to be a national search.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, often somebody with inside knowledge of the university or the college or the city, or, you know, what the particular challenges are in a certain department, sort of has just sort of a natural home field advantage. And sometimes they get the job. I would just say it's really, the chances are pretty slim, though, that one, you know, part-time will lead to full-time at the same university. But just the numbers game of it, you know, the odds. And,
yeah.
You know, I've been on a lot of search committees, and search committees are confidential, but search committees do tend, you know, to get really excited about outside influence, right? They tend to think that that's going to be really good for a department or a university or college. And that, you know, that's the opposite of the home field advantage, right? That's the drawback. And, you know, there, as you know, there are so few jobs in the arts that, you know, you say, oh, we're hiring for a sculpture professor. And sometimes you get, you know, at a school with a good program, seriously, you might get 4,000 applications.
Wow. You know? Wow. As a search, as a member of a search committee, what's the biggest number of people that were applying for one spot that you recall?
I hope that 4,000 isn't an exaggeration, but I think I heard that. I have mostly been on searches that have, you know, the administrative searches tend to have you know, and sort of like a director of a department do tend to have less people because people sort of select out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you see searches with 100 candidates.
Okay. Yeah. That's still a lot. Still a lot. Yeah. What about this phenomenon? I'd be interested to hear your take on it. In which any given program, you know, whether they've got 100 applicants or 4,000, the most attractive candidates are art stars, because when they hire an art star, the students are going to be more likely, student candidates or potential students are going to be more likely to go to that school because of the name recognition.
This is such a good topic. So much to say. So wait, can you rephrase the question? What's the essential nugget of the question?
I think the nugget of the question is, how often have you seen that? And is it just the reality, the majority of the time?
I mean, it depends what an art star means, but, you know, let's take, I don't know, like, give me an art star.
Well, I mean, here in Los Angeles, you have people at UCLA like Catherine Opie. That's a pretty big name. You know, you can take most well-known institutions, you know, not your smaller colleges that people wouldn't have heard of outside the city, right? But your bigger, UNLV definitely qualifies. But you got several of those types of schools in Los Angeles. You got, you know, a few in the Bay Area. You have a ton in New York, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be somebody, young artists or young art students probably would have heard of, I guess.
Yeah. This is so much fun to think about. I hope you can get Kathy Opie on your podcast and ask her, you know, ask her what the real story is here, because I have heard some sort of, they're probably in the realm of fables, but sort of reminiscences about her early academic life. And I think if I'm correct, I could be wrong, fact check needed. You know, she may have started as a part-timer at University of California, Irvine, where I went to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would posit, and I'd be happy to be wrong on this, especially with someone as formidable as Kathy Opie, but what I would posit is that when Kathy Opie started teaching, she was at a different place in her career. And so I think, you know, a lot of what, like, a strategic department or college like ought to be looking for is, you know, somebody who's going to make a huge impact on their field, that somebody who's sort of where Kathy Opie is now, that, gosh, you know, she's probably so busy she doesn't have time for her friends and family, right? I mean, I'm sure she makes time, it's not a criticism, but she, you know, she's really busy, right?
Yeah.
And I imagine that she must love teaching or she wouldn't be doing it, right?
Yeah.
From the perspective of a department chair, you know, and I think the department wants, you know, folks who are going to serve on, you know, curriculum revision committees, folks who are going to help with the speaker series, folks who are going to help me identify who's a good technician to do maintenance on the equipment in our shop. You know, someone who's going to show up at the, you know, the Halloween party, or, you know, listen in the faculty meeting to the sustainability committee and ask good questions about health and safety, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that couldn't be somebody who, but I think, you know, just on a human level, it might be hard to turn down meetings with collectors to sit in a health and safety meeting.
I couldn't agree with you more. I want you to have those kind of people, and I want you to hire those kinds of people, you know, for sure. And maybe my big subtext, because I've mentioned this on the show before, is that it can be extremely frustrating, the concept of the pyramid, you know, the top of the pyramid when it comes to everything. You know, it's like you are at the top of the pyramid in the art market, and then you're also at the top of the pyramid in academia. You know, it's like you're taking up all the good spots, and the people who are not having lucrative careers in the market, you know, could really use those teaching jobs. And they're not available because the art stars have them. Just
right.
as a general concept, that really drives me up the wall.
I feel your frustration. I underline and highlight your frustration and would, you know, add exclamation points to it. I think, you know, one way to think about it might be that there, and, you know, something I've been encouraging, you know, with my bosses along the way, but also with my coworkers, is that we look really hard at the different labor groups that are participating in academic life. And, you know, we think about, and, you know, we have these conversations not behind closed doors, but in open and public, in the press, and with the people who are doing the work and with the students, to say, what is appropriate for who, you know, that I want students to engage with somebody who's just out of grad school, has all this fire and energy and all these new ideas. I also want that person, if they want to pursue, a job in a design firm, to pursue that job. I want that person, you know, if they want to pursue a job on Comedy Central, to pursue that job, right? I also want somebody, and lots of somebodies, who can be with the students in the classroom and walk in and say, look, this is how you handle a gallery, or this is how, you know, I worked with Burger King as a design client, and this is what it's like. And, you know, so I think in order to do that, we need to create a lot of different labor scenarios, and just be, you know, apply our creativity that we apply in our classrooms and in our studios, apply it to how we think about employment, and have, you know, real honest conversations with people to say, if I want somebody, I always think of somebody like Saul LeWitt. He's one of my favorite artists, right? Like, how do you get Saul LeWitt in the classroom? You're not gonna get him, you know, 3 days a week for 6 hours each day, right? But absolutely, you want the students to engage with him. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And some artists are maybe just good for a class trip, studio visit, and that's it, because that's about all that artist is going to be able to offer in terms of a mentor, mini mentor, you know, interactive type experience.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And I have worked with a couple people over the years who have sort of cracked the code. And, you know, maybe I'll suggest that you interview those folks at some point, because there are folks who do sort of move effortlessly through these multiple realms, and the education is happening all the time, and the professional development is happening all the time, and you don't see the sweat stains. I mean, it's pretty remarkable when you see it, and it's like you said, it's a little strange that we have a whole educational system and market system built around it, because it's very rare.
Yeah.
Very rare.
Yeah, that's a great image that you just created, the armpit sweat stain free individual moving seamlessly through professional and academic worlds. Yeah, sure, I'll talk to those people. That sounds like a plan. You mentioned just a couple minutes ago Comedy Central, and as an example, and then you mentioned you're writing scripts earlier, and I know that I presume you write scripts for your performances. Do you write scripts for anything else other than your performances?
Just my performances.
Okay.
You know, being in Las Vegas, you know, I'm looking to get discovered.
Right. Yeah. Well, why don't you take one of your performances to the Strip?
I'm working on that.
Good. Good. All right. Well, I did want to pivot to performance art, which you will be teaching, have taught presumably, and do, and you know, are active in. So my first question is, both for your own performances and generally for performances, how important would you say it is for them? I know this is case by case, but just go with me anyway. How important is it to see the performances in person versus a video of them?
Oh my God. I'm almost existing totally without video.
Right.
Sometimes this is one of the things I give myself a hard time about. Like, if I was more diligent about video, then, you know, I could have a better career, because, you know, a video can travel without you, right? You just send the file.
Yeah.
And, you know, might not even have to show up for the festival or the screening, right?
Yeah.
But I just don't really care about video. I care about other people's videos, but I just really don't care about making them. And so, often what I'll do is hire a friend or a graduate student, pay them something to come and make a a video of what's basically, you know, sort of the dress rehearsal for the performance when it's first constructed. And I'll ask them to do some real minimal editing and insert titles and things. But I've rarely exhibited those as, you know, works in and of themselves. I really just use them so that people, you know about, so, you know, can get a sort of idea of what I do. And I, you know, really what gives me the charge is doing the performance.
Yeah.
And I would say my favorite avenue is, you know, a gallery packed with 40 people, you know, myself and maybe two or three other performers doing a half hour performance. That's gotten me through a lot. And I don't know if I need much more than that.
Well, I'm glad you said all that, because that was what you really anticipated. It's sort of one of my follow-up questions, like how many people do you feel like you need to have a satisfying performance and so on. But the other thing that I wanted to ask you is, when you do a performance like that, what do you want your typical viewer of your performance to get? How do you want them to be moved? Do you want them to be enlightened? Do you want them to be, you know, I'm not going to throw out a bunch of adjectives because I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what would you say? And I'm thinking as I'm saying this, that this may be kind of a ridiculous question, because it's like, well, what do you want somebody when they look at a painting or a sculpture to get from it? Right. But I think it seems to me even more pressing when it comes to performance, because you're really putting a lot of demands on the viewer of a performance, because they're in this really intimate, often awkward space, you know? So it seems like they should, and what they get, it seems almost more up to you than it does when they look at a inanimate object.
I think this is, you know, has been essentially, it's a good question. It's not a silly question. It's been an essential question for me. You know, I watch Netflix just like everybody else does. I watch HBO. I love narratives, right?
Right.
The space of performance and what I sort of gravitate towards when I start to work with props or when I collect text or I start to talk to performers, I don't always know what it's about when I start. I think often it starts to be about something through working on it. And then, you know, sometimes it's one of those things, like I think with a lot of aspects of creation, where you're like, duh, of course that's what it's about, Mark is, you know? and I just did a performance recently in Baltimore where I had this idea of reading the news as the performance was happening, as the more abstract gestures were happening. And I had lunch with an art historian who was in town, who writes on and studies Fluxus, and who's incredible, named Natalie Herron. And she reminded me that I was sort of channeling a Simone Forti performance, where Simone Forti would sort of dance to the news. And that was the week that the, Trump was putting children in cages. And so, you know, after that conversation with Natalie, it just sort of hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, you know, that's the news to read while these other things are going on.
Right.
And so, you know, there was certainly confusion in the audience. And I think the gallery director reported to me that, you know, some people, the content was too much, you know. But it wasn't like I sat down and said, you know, it's not like I heard the news and said, oh, Marcus, you have to make a piece about this. I sort of stumbled around into it.
Right. For those who, well, first, here, this is a two-part question. One is, how is performance doing these days, performance art doing? It seems like it's doing pretty well. It's pretty healthy in terms of participation, exposure in institutions, and so on. So that's kind of just like a leading question. But the real question I have is, how would you sell somebody on performance art these days, especially when a vulnerable or a potential weakness of performance art is that it can be seen as self-parody in a lot of cases?
Oh, that's not where I thought you were going to go. I thought you were going to go to the market aspect. Say more about self-parody.
Yeah, well, in other words, when one watches a performance and absurdity reigns in one way or another, maybe without, I'm thinking, well, maybe that's a lack of education, you know, lack of the history, lack of familiarity with the history of performance art. But at the same time, I think it's also a fair angle to consider that, you know, and that's also, and then this also goes back to my original question about seeing it in person, you know, versus a video, because I think one is more likely to miss some of the potency of a performance when, you know, when they don't see it in person. But in any case, when one sees a ritual of absurdity, you know, that goes back to Dada, if not before, there's something about it because of that vocabulary that for some viewers, I think, feels like a self-parody. You know what I mean? Like, oh, this is like a cliche of performance art. You know what I mean?
Right. I think you're very perceptive, and this is present in my work as well, I think, is one of the reasons you're bringing it up, that someone like Paul McCarthy, for example, is, you know, very much in the tradition of, working in various traditions of clowning.
Yeah.
You know, it might as well be, you know, Commedia dell'arte or, you know, Ringling Brothers with a big, big red nose. I mean, of course, he takes it other directions,
yeah,
you know, incredible other directions, but it's, you know, that's foundational in the work. And, you know, I think about sort of the tradition of the fool, right, or the court jester,
mm-hmm,
a lot with my work, especially because, you know, I do like to think of myself as someone who's engaged with politics, if even abstractly. You know, what does it mean to be sort of, you know, staging scenarios where I fall on my face or, you know, do something, as you say, absurd, I think is a word I like a lot. So that's one piece, right? I hear the other piece of your question is that there are cliches of performance art now. And, you know, one essay I like to have students read is where David Sedaris talks about his forays into performance art. And in his typical way, you know, he's completely self-deprecating and making fun of himself. And, you know, as a student, he was engaged in so many of the cliches of performance art. And I read that essay after I had already very publicly and very broadly performed some of those same cliches.
Oh, right.
So
nice.
I think that it is a discipline, performance art, that has many, many pitfalls, and I can't pretend to have missed them. I think I've been deep in some of those holes. And I guess, you know, if I'm being gentle to myself, I think of it like, well, you know, painting has its sunsets and, you know, rock music has its love songs, right? But that doesn't mean that you don't paint sunsets and you don't write love songs. You're just trying to write, you know, one that that's better, or paint one that's not a cliche. And in, you know, in that way, you know, if you fail, you're not alone.
Yeah. Well, that raises a question I think you're really a perfect person to address, with being an interdisciplinary person yourself, you know, somebody who has a certain amount level of expertise or at least strong familiarity with all of the disciplines. How do you think performance art compares in its degree of difficulty with the other disciplines? You know, you mentioned the sunset, you know, in painting, and what was the other one?
Oh, a love song.
The love song in music, right. So is, like, if we were to take those analogies over to performance art, and performance art is the pitfall of a cliche, how do you see the degree of difficulty? Because, yeah, you know, when you look at painting, you go, there are a lot of pitfalls in painting because people are doing the same shit over and over again, right? Does it feel any different with performance art?
I think you could look at it a lot of different ways. One way to think about it is that it's also part of what attracts people to the discipline.
Yeah.
Right. When I was in graduate school, a friend from undergrad was a little bit ahead of me. He's very accomplished, visual artist now, and he had gotten out of grad school and was already showing widely. And we went to an opening together, and he introduced me to some people, and I said, hey, I have a performance coming up, and that the people asked me what it was about, and these were people I didn't know, and I started to actually describe the performance.
Right.
And then, I watched their eyes glaze over. they'll never come see anything I do ever, right?
Right, right.
And so my friend, on the other hand, said, you know, so what if when people asked you what your performance is going to be like, you played with that a little bit, right? Like the performance begins in some ways when you start talking about it.
Right.
And so, you know, he said, you know, why don't you say, you know, whenever anyone asks you what you're doing in the performance, what if you said something more like, it's buckets of blood, buckets of urine, don't sit in the front row.
Yeah.
And
love
even
it.
If there's no blood or urine anywhere in the performance, it's more likely that they're going to show up than my saying, well, it's a reflection on the limits of love, and I was really thinking about sunsets, and what is the equivalent of a sunset, and perform, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. That's great. But going back to this idea of what, you know, maybe you hope for as a result of doing the performance, it feels like, if I read, again, reading between the lines, that maybe there's an ambition of having sort of a group catharsis. It's like you're cleansing, you know, I don't know if souls is too, you know, heavy-handed a word, but, you know, it's like a sort of a group artistic cleansing of sorts. Do either of those analogies feel...
That resonates.
Okay, good.
Maybe that's where the buckets of blood and urine come out.
Right. Yeah.
lately I've really been working with this idea almost of a protest gym. My friend is also a visual artist, and I were at the Women's March together in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a young woman who was doing a call and response from a tree, and, you know, very passionate and amazing. And the Women's March in D.C. was so cramped with people that we couldn't even really march. You know,
right.
We were just sort of there. And my friend Molly said to me, hey, why don't you get up and do your performance? And I thought about it, but I had this sort of visceral response where I was like, well, actually, you know, what I'm hoping to do with my performance is it's like more of a gym, in the sense that, you know, my feeling is that, you know, not just art people, but people in general, if we are going to stand up for ourselves, if we are going to protest, if we are going to point out what we think is wrong, that, you know, maybe we need some practice doing that. And that, you know, I have been really happy with the result of that so doing a call and response in a gallery, that the actual words might feel more like poetry, less like politics, or suggesting some gestures and running through some gestures with people in a gallery that get their bodies moving in public in a way that, you know, they might not even move them at the pool or at the yoga studio, that I have the idea anyway, and I've gotten the sense that this might, at least, you know, a small group of people, make them feel more primed.
Mm-hmm. Right. Is there a phenomenon in performance art that you've noticed in which maybe some people, I don't know how to put this, there's ambition to maybe expand their work, or if not sort of transition their work and their foundations and performance into a more mainstream version of performance? In other words, you know, like Blue Man Group, for lack of a better example, you know what I mean? Or even stand-up or sketch comedy or what have you. I mean, does that feel like a betrayal to you when somebody is a performance artist or has been working in performance and then they sort of scoot over into that more entertainment/mainstream arena?
No, it's awesome. I mean, you know, Buster Keaton, Andy Kaufman, Laurie Anderson, these folks are heroes. Adrian Piper,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, all folks who are very much sort of straddling that line of like, you know, what is art, what is entertainment, and
right.
In the case of Adrian Piper, like what's an enactment of politics and what's actually politics, and who's politics. These are all questions I hope to be posing to the students this semester in class.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I mean, I hope this doesn't get too fine-grained, but, I mean, Andy Kaufman is a great example, for sure. I mean, because he's like the ultimate mainstream performance artist, right? But when you look at Adrienne Piper, you know, who's great in her own right, was she ever doing her performance outside of an art world context? I mean, she was doing things in public, so to that extent, yes. But they were they not, or have they not been sort of more in the context of performance art?
Yeah, more than Andy Kaufman, for sure. And Adrienne Piper is also another person who should speak for herself. I wouldn't pretend to speak for her, but in terms of what she taught me was, you know, I really love these cards that she would give out after. My understanding is that, you know, she had insulted or even degraded, or what we might now call microaggressions or macroaggressions in public, and she would give out a card that she had pre-printed in her wallet that suggested, you know, she'd experienced this before, she was expecting this, and she would just, you know, hand the person, rather than explain it to the person in conversation, she'd just hand them the card, you know, a little bit of education right there at the cocktail party.
Right.
And so, you know, in that way, you know, for me, as an art student, you know, she really opened up just like a whole avenue of thinking there are other artists too, right? Like this. But for her, she's one of the names I put on that, where I really start to feel like, oh, you know, well, performance is existing everywhere. But then there's a whole set of questions that come with that. Like, if somebody is performing politically, you know, we all talk about the kind of performance that Trump does, right? But it has, you know, really serious implications. So does talking about it as performance make light of it or of the real human implications? Or does talking about it as performance give us another way to react to it, to deal with it, to process it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To compare you, though, and your work to Adrienne Piper, which I know, you know, it might be a little intimidating of a prospect, but the thing that I want to get to is the fact that, as you well explained, she sort of made her performances a public thing or brought them into the public arena. And then I thought back to you at the Women's March, you know, and your friend suggested, you know, you do your performance. You're like, I don't know if this is the best place for it. You know what I mean? How open do you think you are to trying out some performances in public where you don't have the framing of a gallery or, you know, a theater space?
It's like a million times harder.
Yeah.
You know, the gallery frame is really useful. People are coming into it, you know, expecting the unexpected, and they, you know, they tend to respect the artist by entering the space, you know?
Yeah.
I've been in other sort of performance festival contexts where I've gotten into, or, you know, even poetry readings is somewhere where it's a little bit more of a sort of fluid space sometimes too, where I've performed that I've had hecklers. I performed at an art fair once where the gallerist didn't know that I was going to be doing this performance, and they didn't quite know the volume that I was using.
Right.
And I had all kinds of hecklers, and those were art people, but it's just the context hadn't been set up, right? Like,
right.
There wasn't a stage for performance. There wasn't a printed program. People weren't alerted in advance. And so, you know, I was a nuisance, which, you know, often you are in public too, right? When you come in a big costume, you're interrupting people's everyday flow. You're going to make them late to work. You're asking them to think about things that they may not have selected to think about. They didn't read a press release. They didn't click yes on a Facebook invite. You're just putting it in their face.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's really hard. Those times that I have done that, it takes a whole different kind of energy, and sometimes a different character comes out, you know, a sort of angrier performer comes out of me.
Right.
If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere.
Right.
In the sense that, you know, what you learn as sort of more of a, for lack of a better word, you know, street performer, I think will make you a stronger performer anywhere. In that, as a performer, you are sort of controlling an audience, right? Like you, or not, you know. But you're sort of you're modulating yourself in relationship to them. And you know, a lot of my performances, even in a controlled context, will have, you know, aspects of of audience interaction, or I'll bring somebody up on stage. And I learned when I lived in San Francisco between undergrad and grad, my neighbor was Guillermo Gomez Pena. Mm-hmm. And I used to go watch his performances when he performed locally, which was, you know, frequent. And, oh my gosh, you know, he, just watching him was a whole, you know, a whole like college degree in working with audiences, you know, and, you know, you figure it out from, you know, what you're asking people to do, who you select to come up on stage. You know, you can't take your eyes off them, right? Because you never know what they're going to do. And I'm still like making mistakes. The last performance I did recently, I made the mistake of putting on a mask while I left other performers on stage. And so I couldn't see them. Mm. And I just sort of assumed they would keep doing what I asked them to do, I thought we'd sort of agreed on, but they did not.
Wow. Right. So you're still trying to implement some of the skills that he seems to have with controlling an audience.
Yeah. And you know, I think there are real like sort of ethical and moral obligations too. And someone like Guillermo Gomez Pena, again, is sort of like playing on this, like he'll have people take off their clothes and write on their skin. I mean, it's a, you know, he's really like testing the limits. And you know, it's something I think about too, like, oh, you ask people to do something, are you being honest about what you want from them? Are they okay with this? Or are you embarrassing them in public? You know?
Yeah. When you were talking about Adrian Piper, you mentioned some of the comments that she was getting in, you know, in parties and whatnot, and the cards she handed out. And you mentioned what we now call microaggressions or macroaggressions. And I, my thoughts briefly turned to back to UNLV and the campus and academia and whatnot. And I guess one sort of additional thing that I wanted us to look at is, you know, what it's like, going to be like for you, what it has been like, and maybe what you're anticipating as far as the current climate of university in terms of everything from diversity to trigger warnings to Me Too, obviously, and so on. You know, I mean, you know, these things are probably great and horrible at the same time, aren't they?
Yeah, and just in the last decade of being in higher ed's almost unrecognizable from when I started.
Yeah, how so? Explain.
You know, the students are. I started teaching college, university level at UC Irvine while I was a grad student, and then was hired on for some courses when I finished. And the that population is somewhat similar to demographically and also, you know, educational background, educational style, the UNLV, but a lot of the factors have really switched. And I think, I guess my short answer is that the students are really leading something of a revolution right now. I think that what I tell students when they come to me with, you know, similar questions that you're asking or more specific questions, I say that, you know, they're going to remember having been in college during 2018 and it's in the U.S. and that people are going to talk about this the way we talk about being in college in the U.S. in 1968. You know, all of the variables, of course, are not the same, but it's as momentous a moment of change.
Yeah.
I'm trying to lean into it. I'm absolutely trying to lean into it. And I think if we don't, we will get left behind. That this generation, I'm meeting fierce warriors, and I'm meeting people who are all of the things that it's comfortable for me to talk about on a sofa with a beer in my hand from a distance and talk about, you know, maybe we can achieve this over time. These are students who, and alumni and young faculty who want change right now. And, you know, like today isn't good enough kind of thing, you know?
Sorry to interrupt your train of thought there, but hold that thought. I'm curious, do any of these students who are warriors have any covert or overt resentment to you because you're a white male?
I'm certain they do. I mean, like we were talking about at the beginning of this interview, you know, I I come from a position of extreme privilege. Third generation Ivy League kind of guy, East Coast. That would only be right in some ways. And, you know, I try. It's very hard because, you know, my ego is substantial, right? it's very hard to remind myself that I might not be correct, or I might have to adjust my language, or I might have to adjust my behavior, or I might just have to, you know, use my language, but just get the fuck out of the way.
Yeah, right. So that's coming. That's to come, though. You haven't really had any major confrontations of note just yet, or have you?
I want to say that, you know, anyone's come and sort of point a finger in my face, or, you know, question my, you know, do I deserve to be in the position I'm in or something like that. But I would welcome it, and I probably deserve it. And since we're talking about performance artists, there was one point when I was teaching performance to a class at MICA, a group of graduate students who were very sophisticated. And, you know, I wanted to introduce them to performance art. It was in a conversation around, like, what we're having around creating an ideal context for curating performance. And I showed them Chris Burden's Shoot piece. And I talked to them a little bit by way of introduction about what was going to happen in the room that they would see. And I talked to them about what I thought was, you know, him trying to create even a cathartic or a psychic response to war and to violence by, you know, making himself something of sort of a sacrificial lamb through which people could deal with their feelings around it. And, you know, it was a class of about 20, 25 students. And they were like, later for Chris Burden, you know, they didn't like it. They didn't like that I showed it. And, you know, they were like, we want to know more about this man. And we want to know more about why you in particular, you know, of all the examples you could have used to illustrate performance art, why you chose this one. And I was shocked. I was shocked because, you know, Chris Burden went to UC Irvine, so I sort of identified with him. I had met him when I lived in Los Angeles, and, you know, he was something of a hero to me. I love the way that his work is so stripped down, and it sort of is what it is, right? And I love the way he makes relics of his performances and how he documents his performances. And I hadn't thought carefully about what it meant in Baltimore in about, you know, 2013, a city that's divided on racial and economic lines, that has one of the highest gun violence rates in the country. I hadn't thought about what it meant to show students a piece where a white man is voluntarily having himself shot. That was a blunder. It was stupid.
Wow. That's a really great illustration of a wake-up call, you know, that spans that period that you mentioned, having started teaching as a grad student just 5 years ago, and how much things have changed. And also, of course, the context, as we were talking about, you know, how different that is. First of all, you don't know who Chris Burden is, you know? It's like, no, not only do we not know, we don't want to know.
Right.
Yeah, that's harsh. But yeah. Obviously, yeah, good education, you know, nobody, for you, right?
Nobody fired me, or it didn't hit the press or anything, but,
right.
But you know, I had some teary conversations with students, and that's just an example. There, you know, there are other students who've gone, you know, toe to toe with me, who said, for example, you know, like, this is not the kind of feedback I want on my writing. You know, like, I know that that you think, you know, you're giving me the feedback that I need, but this is not what I want.
Right.
You know, and because you're my teacher, and because, like, I've chosen to study with you, I want more of the kind of feedback that I want. The particular student that I'm thinking of, oh my God, I think, you know, I'll remember that moment forever. And she, you know, I'm always a reference for her. Her career is, you know, astounding to me. And, you know, I'm proud to say that she is a peer now. And I would think of her as having taught me so much in the classroom. And what I would say, I guess maybe sort of like the ribbon on this is that for faculty out there and for people teaching out there, what I try to stress is that the educational space is an educational space for everyone.
Right. How are you feeling right now? And do you feel like there's anything that we haven't touched on for this particular performance context that we should have?
I feel opened up. I feel like we definitely got somewhere, didn't we?
Oh, we totally got somewhere. We got somewhere and beyond.
This was fun. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you, Marcus. Thank you so much.
Sure. My pleasure.
And we're out. Thank you so much again to Marcus. I hope you guys enjoyed that. He was great to talk to, wasn't he? Or listen to in your case. So we've got some great Weiss links coming up. Before we get there, I did want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. I want to thank the people who have stepped up in the last couple of weeks to join the patrons list. And what that is, for those of you who don't know, it's something I just started. It's on the support page of theconversationpod.com. It is patrons of the conversation, and just people who have donated $50 or more over the years. It doesn't have to be all in one go to the show. So it is a list of their names, and they are linked to their respective websites. So if you would like to be on the website of the conversation and have your site linked, you just need to be somebody who's donated $50 or more over the years to the show. So I encourage you to do so one way or another. You can donate to the show via Patreon. You can do so via PayPal. You can do so via Venmo. All of those are mentioned on the support page of the show. And if you pledge $5 or more a month via Patreon, $30 or more one time via PayPal or Venmo, I will add you to the bonus crew of the show, which means you'll get all the bonus episodes and a bumper sticker and more. And soon we're going to be giving away some nice things to encourage you to donate to the show. In fact, Marcus Sivan himself is donating some drawings, so we'll look forward to those in the very near future, so stay tuned. Of course, you can also support the show by leaving a nice review on iTunes/Apple Podcasts. That's linked through the support page as well. Really does help new listeners find the show, so if you haven't already reviewed the show, please do so. And of course, you can follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. Thank you very much in advance. All right, let's get to these Weiss links, the Weiss links for the week. So from good old Richard Prince, I had to go with this one. The reason it took so long to pick an artist for the American Pavilion in Venice, he writes, was Trump lobbied for Ralph Cowan? I don't know who that is either. Reason it took so long to pick an artist for the American Pavilion in Venice was Trump lobbied for Ralph Cowan. He wanted this Cowan to be front and center and to be printed on sweaters and sold in the gift shop. Steve Wynn's Bellagio was the sponsor. The show was to be called Painting Isn't Painting. All right, and on to more serious news. This is from the LA Times' Carolina Miranda. Art galleries are leaving Boyle Heights, but more anti-gentrification battles loom. For more than 2 years, members of BHAAAD, a coalition of anti-gentrification groups in Boyle Heights, have repeatedly demanded that galleries leave the neighborhood. What the neighborhood needs, the groups insist, is more affordable housing, as well as residential services such as grocery stores and laundromats. Publicly vowing to, quote, stop at nothing to fight gentrification and capitalism in its boring art-washing manifestations, unquote, the group has staged protests, called for boycotts, and used social media in savvy and withering ways. For example, describing one gallery owner as bearing the, quote, stench of entitlement and white privilege, unquote. There have been other more questionable tactics, too. A couple of galleries have reported anonymous death threats and other harassment. In 2016, an anonymous vandal spray-painted an epithet about, quote, white art on the gates of Nicodeme Gallery. Last month, a statement appeared on the website of BBQLA, a space just off Whittier Boulevard, apologizing for its role, quote, as hipster bro gentrifiers who have colonized Boyle Heights with our gallery, unquote. The gallery's director stated via email that their website had been hacked, and they declined to comment further so as not to, quote, perpetuate negativity, unquote. I know one of those BBQLA guys. The Tom Selleck of the art world, I think, is one of the ways he goes by. It's Thomas Linder. And Thomas, if you want to come on the show and talk to me about it, or for some other reason, you are invited. You are hereby invited, sir. All right, so let's move on to this piece about Dale Henry, who, like you, I had not heard of, but it's a great story. This is via Art News, and the caption is, or the title is, "What a Generous Gesture, But..." Dale Henry was an artist who met with some success in New York in the 1960s and 70s, notably showing with Alana Heiss at the Clock Tower Gallery and the PS1 Contemporary Art Center, as well as with the dealer John Weber, before leaving the city in disgust and landing in rural Virginia to work in isolation for the rest of his life. When Henry died in 2011 at the age of 80, and more than three decades after having fled what he perceived as New York's market-minded preoccupations and mislaid artistic attentions, Heiss was notified that his will called for all of his work to be left to her, with the stipulation that it either be given away for free or destroyed completely. That left only museums and sympathetic recipients as prospective caretakers for hundreds of paintings and sculptures whose fate hung in the balance. Though the posthumous request came as a surprise, Heiss took on the duty, with some reluctance, and proceeded to exhibit Henry's work, first in a tribute at the Clock Tower Gallery in Lower Manhattan in 2013, in its final exhibition there, and then the next year in a bigger show at Pioneer Works in Brooklyn. Since then, Heiss and curator Beatrice Johnson, the project director of the whole affair, have toiled to find homes for the works, many of them post-minimalist and conceptually inclined paintings made with unorthodox materials, to live on in an endeavor that recently wrapped after years of planning and execution. Among the institutions that have acquired works by Henry as a result are the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Brooklyn Museum, Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas, the Cleveland Museum of Art, and the Birmingham Museum of Art. Individuals who wound up with the works as gifts include artist Joan Jonas, Lynn Hirschman Leeson, I've heard of her, Robert Wilson, I've heard of him, Dustin Yellen, and many more, including an Art News writer who was invited to take part in a Henry-related roundtable discussion convened by Heiss in July. Among talks delivered by a varied cast, MoMA curator Laura Hotman, who since left the museum to become executive director of the Drawing Center, Hotman spoke of the challenges and oddities surrounding MoMA's acquisition of a very complicated, multi-part work by an artist of little notoriety. Hotman herself hadn't been familiar with Henry prior to Heiss's recent handling of his work. Join the club, Hotman. But the notion of adding him to the museum's collection came about, Hotman said, after museum trustee Agnes Gund and curator Ann Temkin had seen it and found it to their liking. The work now belonging to MoMA is a sprawling series of wall pieces, dated 1972, made with materials like sand, masking tape, thread, paintbrush, bristles, marker, and pencil on supports like wax paper, linen, acetate sheets, glass, and more, all under the collective title Primer. 80 pieces, 10 each set of 8. What does it mean to acquire a large, space-hungry work by an artist who doesn't have any name recognition? Hotman asked, rhetorically, at the start of her talk. What does it mean to acquire a work that is challenging to install in the way the artist intended? She added, mentioning Henry's meticulous instructions for hanging the work. This one, quote, came with a handbook, she said. Later on, in response to a question about caring for a fragile work that might not go on show anytime soon, Hotman said of MoMA, "We're not just showers, we're preservers, too. Dale Henry will live as long as Les Demoiselles d'Avignon and will be treated in the same manner as Van Gogh's Starry Night." Artist Richard Nonis, I met that guy, interjected that what is most significant about Henry more than any single work in his oeuvre is how he managed to make a legacy for himself after his death. Quote, "I feel like this work exists primarily and to a certain extent only as a conceptual cooperative piece between you and Dale," Nonis said, addressing Heiss. "It's extraordinary, this notion of taking a life's work and giving it away. For every one of these works, the main importance is that it's part of that, and to separate it from that is to kill it." Dale knew he was creating a situation in which it was going to be impossible to look at the works without knowing the history of how they got in front of you. And that, again, is from Art News, Bravo, Dale Henry, for your little mini coup there of getting your work into all these institutions, albeit after you're long gone, but congratulations nonetheless. And that is all the congratulations we have time for this week. Thank you guys so much for listening. Any of you who are potentially game to leave a message on the podcast hotline, I await your calls. We await your calls. So go leave a message of any sort at this point. All right, you guys, thank you so much again. I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.